Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted and honored to have as my guest on the show today, Michael Whitmore. Michael is a Vassar alumnus and he is director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. And he's going to talk to us about the Folger Library. Hello, Mike.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's great to have you on the show. So, first question, we've recently had in the Vassar Library an exhibit on teaching with Shakespeare at Vassar to mark the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, and wanted to point out that both you and the Folger have roots that go back to the Vassar English Department and its long tradition of highlighting Shakespeare in the curriculum. And I'm thinking here of Emily Jordan Folger, who was a class of 1879, who's one of the founders of the Folger Library.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if she has a legacy there at the Folger, along with her husband, Henry Clay Folger.
Well, we think of them as co-founders, and they were clearly partners in the enterprise. Emily Jordan Folger, took an MA degree at Vassar in the texts of Shakespeare's plays. And when she was working with her husband, Henry Clay Folger, who was president of Standard Oil in New York, she and he were gathering auction catalogs, managing a large correspondence, and thinking about how to build their collection. So her background and that tradition of scholarship on Shakespeare at Vassar helped her, alongside Henry, create the single greatest collection for Shakespeare in the world.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that the Folger collected 82 first folios, they, as a couple, did, of the 233 known copies of the book, really was a stroke of brilliance, because once they had, say, more than 10, no one would ever be able to catch up.
Uh-huh.
And she knew, no doubt from her training at Vassar, that every first folio was unique, because as they were printed, they were corrected, but the uncorrected sheets were never thrown away. So as they assembled these books willy-nilly from different states of the page prints, they created these very eclectic volumes. And the only way to figure out what the final corrected version of the folio would be was to systematically compare these folio texts, which is indeed what happened a couple of decades after the Folger was created.
And her master's thesis was on the first folio, promoting the first folio as the authority for Shakespeare's text, wasn't it?
And she that was a very good that she knew about that book.
Yeah, she studied under Truman Backus, who sort of founded Shakespeare studies here. I think he might have been an acquaintance of Matthew Vassar, actually, way back in the 1860s. And then Vassar at that time did have a nice tradition of teaching Shakespeare, I mean, as part of the curriculum, rather early. And I remember reading in the catalog, Emily Jordan was asked to come back in 1915 to give a lecture, and she gave a kind of landmark lecture about, I think it was entitled, Some Women Interpreters of Shakespeare, and it was a landmark lecture in that it was about the place and importance of having women academics in English literary studies. And then, you know, following that, you know, we did hire a couple of very early female academics, including one of the first women to graduate with a PhD in English from Yale, Laura Johnson Wiley.
Well, that tradition continued at the Folger. There's been a line of very distinguished women Shakespearean scholars here. Caroline Spurgeon, who was one of the most distinguished female academics in the world in the early 20th century, left her papers here and worked here, and she wrote a landmark book called The Imagery of Shakespeare's Plays, in which she characterized and counted every image in Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, which had colored graphs in the back of it, was, to my mind, the first digital humanities project on Shakespeare.
Yeah, sort of infographic.
And she was thinking a lot about that.
Yeah.
Then there was Susan Snyder, a truly distinguished interpreter of Shakespeare and his genres, who worked here. Then Barbara Mowat, who is the editor of the Folger Editions, who is still working with our collections. And then Gail Kern Pastor, distinguished Shakespearean writing about the humors, then director of the Folger, and she is editor of Shakespeare Quarterly. And to add to that, Georgiana Ziegler, who is our retired associate librarian and head of reference, mm-hmm. who's done terrific work in female printers and women writers in the 17th century, Elizabeth Eisenstein, who worked in this collection, who led a seminar in the ideas that would develop into her landmark book, mm-hmm. Printing Presses and Agent of Change. So this is an interesting place, in part because what Emily Jordan Folger brought to this institution continued on, and she was very well placed to see that that was an important thread.
Yeah, interesting. I know your reading room reminds me an awful lot of the Thompson reading room, and I wonder when the libraries mm-hmm. were being planned if that was a thought somehow. You know, you've got that huge, beautiful window, you know, over the mm-hmm. main reading room there, and the terraces
right.
also.
I think it's quite possible. Yeah. The correspondence between Henry Folger and Paul Cray, mm-hmm. which I've looked at, is interesting. Cray was a Beaux-Arts architect,
yes.
and he certainly had models for what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Hampton Court, drawings of the globe, early maps of Southwark, and mm-hmm. trying to understand what a theater would look like. There were many models for Renaissance reading rooms, or the kinds of grand reading rooms that are around this country and also throughout Europe. So I think it was probably a mixture of what the Folgers imagined yeah. would be an appropriate place to use this collection, and then some real models that were being used by Cray.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, can you talk about your own time here at Vassar, since you're mm-hmm. an alum, and the influence the institution might have had on you, faculty you studied with, etc.? People aren't always, yeah. I have to say, wholly positive about this, but it's interesting
oh,
you
really?
Know, to hear back from alums. Yeah, well, off and on, you know. Sometimes undergraduate years can be hard on people, I think, sometimes. But
Yeah. Well, I think that people have to be honest about that.
Yeah,
When I was an undergraduate, you know, I was attracted to Vassar because of the humanities and the arts, uh-huh. and I worked a lot in the music department. I studied percussion with a timpanist from the Metropolitan Opera, which was a really exciting thing to be able to do. I was able to study Greek archaeology, which uh-huh. was fascinating, but I spent most of my time in the English department, you know, studying with amazing teachers, among them Leslie Dunn, uh-huh. who was my undergraduate advisor, with whom I studied early modern literature. Barbara Page, who taught just a magnificent class on literary theory that mm-hmm. really did change the way I think about how I read. Mm-hmm. And then Susan McCloskey, who was the person who advised my thesis on Shakespeare and Othello. And that was, for me, the most important experience I had at Vassar, being able to sit with a complex and difficult play yeah. and write about it was really a gift, and also having the access to really accomplished scholars who had the time to spend with a curious undergraduate.
Yeah.
I feel like that was the preparation I needed for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I came to Washington soon thereafter and worked for the National Academy of Sciences and the Library of Congress. I was actually a telemarketer for the Folger Theater, which was my first paying job out of college. And I think I knew I wanted to study something a bit broader than English literature. I wanted to study the rhetoric of science, and that led me to Berkeley. When I encountered Stephen Greenblatt there, my love of Shakespeare was reignited, mm-hmm. and then I really was prepared and in a position to think a lot more deeply about Shakespeare's plays, but then had the advantage of working with several intellectual historians. Stephen was my dissertation chair, mm-hmm. but Hayden White was on my committee, an amazing intellectual historian named Amos Funkenstein, who actually died while I was dissertating and was replaced by another terrific intellectual historian named Lorraine Dastin, who runs the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin, and then a wonderful intellectual historian from the rhetoric department, which is where I studied, Barbara Shapiro.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, you know, one of the things that Vassar allowed people to do was to be creative in how they combined different traditions of thinking. Yeah. That was certainly the case for me at Vassar. I was interested in how Shakespeare's plays were connected to changing ideas of knowledge and objectivity. And once I got to Berkeley, I had a chance to jump back into those questions with even more resources and time to think about them. Yeah. But certainly the values of Vassar College, which are about the freedom and the intensity of inquiry, the dedication to close contact with faculty, mm-hmm. the small searching classes, emphasis on learning how to write, those were things that were just invaluable for me. And so I'm very grateful for them.
It's something to be said for liberal arts education generally, that it doesn't box you in necessarily to a specific discipline or a specific field of study, and you can make these kinds of connections. You know, so
well, there has to be confidence. I mean, the faculty has to be confident that students aren't just messing around and can recognize what true and powerful interdisciplinary thinking is. So I think Vassar was well ahead of the curve there.
Yeah. Can you talk then about the Folger a bit, you know, just by way of introduction, mm-hmm. about its mission and collections?
So the Folger was established in 1932. It was privately funded and created by the Folgers. However, the U.S. Congress, which had landmarked this land for the Adams Building, uh-huh. the expansion of the Library of Congress,
yeah.
the Congress actually paused as it was thinking about what to do with this parcel of land, because Mr. Folger contacted the Librarian of Congress to say, I have a collection of inestimable value that probably the United States government could not afford to create. Mm-hmm. It is my intention to place it in a building two blocks east of the U.S. Capitol and make it a gift to the American people, mm-hmm. in an organization that is dedicated to the public. And that is what the congressional record says as the Congress was deciding to let over this piece of land to mm-hmm. Mr. Folger. So I find that very interesting and instructive, because it means that the Folger's ambitions for this place was that it should be a full part of the culture of the United States Capitol and mm-hmm. the nation, and that the plays of not only Shakespeare, but the record of the early modern period from roughly 1470s, the introduction of print in England, mm-hmm. through to about 1730, belonged in Washington and should be understood by the nation. So in the early period of the Folger, the library focused on organizing and expanding the collection, creating a series of fellowships so that it would be used, mm-hmm. serving as a kind of a platform for, really, Folger funded a huge amount of Shakespeare scholarship and uh-huh. created a lot of it yeah. on its own. But in our building, if you've ever been here, and I invite your listeners to come. It's probably the only Art Deco Tudor building in the world. It's a Deco temple.
Yeah.
On the outside and on the inside, it looks like a building you could have walked into 400 years ago.
Yeah.
I think Shakespeare would have recognized all three of our historic rooms, the reading room, the pastor reading room, the Great Hall, which is a city block long with soaring ceilings and yeah. plaster work and oak paneling, and then the first Tudor Theater in North America mm-hmm. is also under our roof. So what that tells me is that the Folgers had a deep sense of how many art forms and many ways of engaging the public and scholars really mattered. And so the rest of the history of the Folger has been about, I think, catching up to that grand vision. And the Folger is doing things now, which I'm not sure our founders could have even imagined. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we took copies of the first folio and sent them to 50 states and two territories this year to celebrate the 400th anniversary uh-huh. of Shakespeare's death. And those books have been seen, by the end of this celebration, will have been seen by about 500,000 people.
Ah, amazing.
So that's the largest yeah. celebration of a single edition rare book, yeah. I think, in the history of this country, and probably also the largest celebration of a British cultural figure yeah. since the creation of the Republic. Yeah. So the ability of a place like the Folger to serve as a resource for the most widely read writer in the world and a doorway to the humanities is something that excites me as director. 95% of Americans, if they are in the school system will encounter Shakespeare at least once before mm-hmm. they're 18.
It was the case with me when I was high school and even junior high. You know, it was always in the curriculum, Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, Macbeth, you know.
Correct.
Still is, yes.
And it's in everybody's interest, but it's in our interest, too, that experience is a terrific experience because it, once that door opens, students will then feel entitled to a lifetime of interest in the arts, in complex language, in poetry. And so we, by virtue of what we have and our ability to share it, can really serve as that doorway through which I hope many, many young people walk. And at a period when the value of the humanities is less certain, I think one of the proof points is the work that is being done by scholars and actors and playwrights and exhibitors here at the Folger.
You have an active theater there then, yes? You mentioned that
you
were a telemarketer for the theater. I'm trying to imagine that, you know, calling people on the phone trying to put Shakespeare tickets.
So it was a very interesting experience.
But you have a wonderful cultural program there, sort of including the theater.
Yeah, so we're performing 3 Shakespeare plays a year in an intimate Tudor theater that seats about 240 people. By virtue of its size and design and the fact that it's furnished with woodwork and it's a very kind of organic place to play, it's one of the greatest rooms in the world to experience the power of the human voice. And so whether it's our actors performing Shakespeare or it's lectures and readings or even we have a Renaissance music consort that is now performing with actors and singers. So I think that one thing I love about what the Folger does is that the written word is so powerful, but there's a claim that the human voice has on all of us.
Yes,
especially if you're in the same room, in the same space. When you can lock eyes with someone who is really saying something, that's very powerful. And so, again, the Folger's vision, I think, was to go all the way from books and manuscripts to the experiences of this period and this writer.
Very early on here at Vassar, the performance of Shakespeare was a huge part of students' experience, both as audience, but also, you know, there are so many people who perform. There was a recognition, and I think a kind of link between the drama department and the English department.
Yes.
About the importance of performance.
And both are still very strong departments.
Yeah, they are, very much so. So is your theater troupe, then, are they employees of the Folger themselves? I mean, do you have your own troupe as well as a space for them?
No. No, we don't. We produce 3 plays a year. We hire a director who then auditions actors. So we don't have a house troupe, but we probably have something like a house style, which is very intimate and aware performances, you know, that it's always a human-scaled thing, but the attention to the language, you know, when you're performing 2 floors above what is essentially the motherlode for Shakespeare and his world of Renaissance London, you are in a room with people who really do know what those words mean.
And I
think that's led to a more knowing style of performance that actually lands very well, even with people who don't know half or of the words they're hearing.
It's a nice image, actually, you know, performers above or in proximity to the texts themselves somehow, as though, you know, that is sort of mind imagining. So you mentioned your outreach sort of generally, and you mentioned the importance of Shakespeare for young people, high school students and junior high school students, just as they're at a point in their lives where they're wondering who they are and have all these kind of yearnings and questions, and then being able to discover somewhere in the culture some kind of a mirror that reflects back to them something that's might help them to find themselves. So do you have a kind of robust outreach program apart from these exhibits? I mean,
So we have trained about 25,000 high school teachers of English who are teaching Shakespeare, and we're bringing them to the Folger to train them. They use our collection. They work with our actors and performers. We have a language-based, performance-based curriculum, which is about using the experience of standing up and actually performing these scenes to get a better handle on the language and the emotions and the plights of these characters. So that was one part of it. Another is that Barbara Mallett and Paul Wurstein created the Folger editions of Shakespeare's plays, mm-hmm. which are the most widely used editions in America. And we've just put those, well, just, we've, 2 years ago, we put the text of those editions online for free.
Uh-huh.
And so that and the other 100,000 high-quality digital images from our collection are a resource for teachers and for students, but if you put together the reach of those teachers and then the students who are using the editions, that's about 3 million people a year.
Yeah.
I really see a value in being a place that is an engine for discovery, and the 800 scholars a year who are here discovering things that are then being written about in the media. That's very important, or they're publishing scholarly monographs and articles. But then to be able to bridge that excitement of the fact that there's still more to know about ourselves in this period so that it lands right in the middle of classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure you could do it with Milton.
Yeah.
But there's a certain, from my point of view, having left the tenure line to come and lead the Folger, if you can't do it with Shakespeare, with the greatest collection of its kind, in a country that mandates the reading, of this playwright, it can't be done in terms of engaging people with the excitement of humanities, scholarship, and thinking.
Yeah.
So I feel really strongly that, in addition to our scholarly mission, and I'm happy to talk more about that, it harmonizes with this sense that, hey, this is for everybody.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. So, in terms of the mission then, and yourself too, you were on a faculty teaching Shakespeare, and then you moved to be director of the Folger. Was that a great transition, and is the mission sort of essentially still the same? Do you think of yourself still as having a calling, and that calling being education, higher education? I would expect so, but...
Well, it's hard to not think like the person I was trained to be. I still do research. I still work on some of the questions around ways of knowing in the Renaissance, and particularly I'm interested in what I would call the poetics of spontaneity, the idea that you could learn something from something that simply just happens, or it happens by accident or by chance. And I also use digital tools to create profiles and explore the now over 50,000 texts that we have that are fully searchable in digital form. So those questions are still alive to me, and I still publish and I collaborate with others. But that work really is not the same as the work I do leading the Folger, which is a cultural institution that ranges from scholarship through to performance exhibitions and education. That suite of activities is extraordinary. And so when I came to the Folger, having taught Shakespeare and Renaissance studies at the University of Wisconsin, and prior to that, Carnegie Mellon, it was a real education for me, not just in learning how all the parts of it run, but it is a cultural institution with a long academic pedigree, with its own governing board. And so those skills of managing an institution, working closely with a board, making sure the mission is right and it matches what we actually do, those are things that I needed to learn or improve on as I was here. I've now been here 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see the mission as changing. I think we were created to be an iconic cultural institution that leads with discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And discovery happens all the time with our collection, but it also happens on stage when you're performing or when you're in an audience and rethinking the story of your life. It happens when you're in an exhibition hall or when you're in a classroom. So I think that was what we were designed to do, finding the resources to see that that happens is an important part of what I do. We are the result of philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
First, the philanthropy of our founders, and we're not a federal institution. We have an endowment of our own, but when you consider that we're the custodians and stewards of one of the greatest cultural records in the world, and that we do it under our own steam, that is an important thing to steward and make sure that we're able to do all those things.
Yeah.
So I enjoy the work that I do. It's challenging, but when you look at, you know, 500,000 people looking at a 400-year-old book, some of them are breaking down in tears. Others are proposing marriage in front of the book, which actually happened. You know,
that's great. Yeah, it must be immensely satisfying. You know, because when you're teaching, you've got maybe 20 souls in front of you that you're lecturing to, or 12 souls around a seminar table. Mm-hmm. But here, I'm thinking of John Dewey's theory of education, that, you know, it's a matter of impact and measurable impact. You have a tremendous effect on other people. So
I think Dewey was right, and I'm still in love with the idea that we can know more and that there are ways of knowing things that are going to change how we are in the world. But it matters to do it in an undergraduate classroom. It matters to do it for graduate students. But really, what we've got to do is connect all of that excitement to actually informing and possibly changing the way people live their lives, because they have this extra register, this extra way of thinking. And, you know, one of the things I learned at Vassar, which is about the humanities, is if the humanities exist for any reason, and there's a lot of reasons why they exist, but one of them has to be is they are there to give fundamentalism a run for its money. And in a world where there are fundamentalisms of all kinds, you know, economic, nationalist, ethnocentric, scientific sometimes, the ability to take that step, which the humanities offers, the ability to live in a moment of disruption or even be a force for disruption while conserving the traditions and the ideas that we have is very powerful. And I think the case for the humanities is going to get stronger and stronger.
Yeah, I would hope so. It has to, because we seem to be drawing fewer and fewer students into the classrooms. Students all want to major in science, feeling some sort of economic benefit.
Well, it's still very hard to staff the demand for Shakespeare. I remember at Wisconsin. It was just... And same at Carnegie Mellon. The idea that you've got these, say at Carnegie Mellon, there's these brilliant engineers and computer scientists and designers. What do they want to do when they have a class that they can take outside of their major? They want to take Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, sure, yeah. You know, the literary canon generally has been demolished, but Shakespeare seems to have survived, you know, still there in the smoke, still the name, the name everyone recognizes. And students feel, I think, still that if they're going to walk away and feel that they earned their education, they need to have some kind of familiarity with Shakespeare.
Well, I'm not sure that the canon has been demolished. It has definitely been widened, and we're in a period, and it needs to happen all the time, a period of sifting through this tradition. When I think of Shakespeare, it's funny, he's, at least in America, he's really an immigrant to this country. He arrives in the 19th century and he's adopted as our national writer. He comes from a multilingual society in which Anglo-Saxon had this amazing encounter with Latin and Norman French, and as a result of that really multilingual society, he is able to use a language that is much more flexible and has more registers. So I think of our moment now in the United States as we try to understand what Shakespeare means and then what all the other wonderful writing means. It's not so much about pinning down what the canon is once and for all, but of continuing to sift through it. And when we sent the first folio out, I thought, well, we got to send it to 50 states because we don't know where that next transformative writer in English is going to come from. Where's the next Toni Morrison going to come? Where's the next William Shakespeare? Well, we don't know, so we ought to bet on all 50 states and two territories, because that's the way we'll find that person.
So you mentioned digital humanities, and I know you've got an interest in digital humanities yourself from your earlier work, maybe at Wisconsin. So does the Folger have a digital library? I mean, you do, you mentioned offer digital materials to the public. You've got the texts, and also, I'm an art librarian, so I know you've got a huge cache of images illustrating Shakespeare's plays
Well, yeah, when I arrived, that was one thing that I brought, was a focus and an intensity about what digital access can do for a collection like ours. And there's always been an emphasis on imaging the collection, that's creating high-quality, beautiful digital images of books and manuscripts. The challenge is, if we were fortunate enough to have the resources to image the entire early modern collection here and could do it overnight, that doesn't necessarily in and of itself create access to the collection. because someone needs to know what they can find there. So the challenges of digital access and digital scholarship are deep, and they require a lot of thinking. Just to give you an example, when an item arrives at the Folger, let's say it's a manuscript, it has to be described by someone.
Mm-hmm, yes. Yeah.
And that person is a cataloger, and depending on what they can say about it, that is the only way that anyone will know what that object is and what it contains. And so for a library, the burden of description is a large one. And it perhaps, you know, next to physical preservation and making things physically available, the single most important stress point for access to what we have. And I would say that a lot of the digital initiatives we have come under the heading of thinking about richer ways of describing or characterizing what we have. Because at some point, you want to have a first-rate cataloger characterize what we have. But then you might have a reader who notices something else about the item and can drop, you know, you hope it's not a breadcrumb. It has to be something that lasts, but can offer an annotation that doesn't carry the authority of a cataloging record, but that is still searchable and that allows someone to reach into the collection and find something very interesting. Or the Folger digital texts, which are the deeply encoded versions of Shakespeare's plays, we thought about that a lot. Mm-hmm. And the way in which those texts were encoded, they are probably the most deeply encoded literary texts available today, by which I mean you can query these texts and say, show me every word that Hamlet says, or even show me every word that Hamlet hears when he's on stage.
Uh-huh.
Or show me all of the nouns. Now that we haven't gone through and annotated all the nouns and the additions, but once you can start doing things like that, you can start to reach people who don't know what to search for. But if they're reading a play like Hamlet and they come to, you know, a Bear Bodkin, well, we have several pictures of Bear Bodkins in our collection. And as long as there is a stable and persistent URL for the word Bodkin, that means a kind of a digital peg that you can always address forever, then there's all kinds of wonderful things that can be hung on that peg. And so we now are in a world, and I think it's incredibly exciting to work in a library now, where the object life of these precious manuscripts and books is starting to live alongside the digital life of them. And to the extent that we can move across that divide, I think we're in for a much more exciting set of uses of our collection.
Yeah, sure. Sounds absolutely fascinating and incredibly useful.
Let me tell you one other thing that you might find interesting about that. We had Turi King here, who's the archaeologist and geneticist who identified Richard III's body when it was exhumed from the car park, verified that it was actually Richard.
Yeah, incredibly interesting.
Very interesting. And she was here talking about that project, and I remembered hearing her talk about sequencing mitochondrial DNA and thinking, you know, there are other sources for old DNA samples, and one of them might be in books.
Uh-huh.
So we, in our conservation lab, took a look at some of our volumes and actually collected some of the dust from the gutters of those books. That's material that is often thrown away when a book is treated or unbound.
Yeah.
And we sent those samples to the National Institutes of Health, where they successfully sequenced the mitochondrial genome of two individuals from that sample, which tells us that in addition to having this magnificent cultural record here, we also have a bioarchive. And so as you think about the future of collections, one of the things that we now need to do is understand the protocols for preserving that evidence and thinking deeply about all the issues connected with having that kind of information in our collection. So I mention it because people think that digital humanities is one of the things that's happening in the world of collections, and it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which conservation science and now genetics is converging on these physical objects is extremely interesting.
Well, last question on everybody's mind. You are a national resource, and the nation is hungry now for some sort of, you know, culture. cultural understanding, maybe, affirmation, given the results of recent elections. So the question is there anything Shakespeare can do to help us get through the next 4 years? You know, and I'm wondering here, you know, maybe about the history plays. If I were a journalist, I'd be repeating to my colleagues the aphorism, be checked for silence, but never for speech, from As You Like It. But not that I expect you to wax wise like Polonius here about this, but... But, you know, culture is a bulwark in times like these and a refuge, isn't it? So,
well, I think you're absolutely right. I think the continuity of Shakespeare's plays and the fact that Shakespeare didn't really, as far as we can tell, he didn't certainly didn't take sides in American elections,
No.
And so, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is that we have members of Congress and justices from the Supreme Court who spend time with us and are curious about our collection and bring very different questions. For some, I'm going to go a little bit broader than Shakespeare, but, you know, if you're thinking about where free speech came from or freedom of inquiry or religious tolerance, those are issues that shook Shakespeare's world and shook the 17th century.
Yes.
And, you know, at a moment, I live in Washington, it's a city that's spinning like a top.
Yes.
But
really,
but it's also a place that has a copy of Magna Carta, the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and a lot happened between those two documents. And a lot of the things that matter in that story of the, you know, what I think of as the progressive legitimation of curiosity and inquiry, the sense of confidence that we can determine our own future by consulting our own experience, the value of skepticism, the conviction that you don't know everything you could know, and that more voices are better. I think those things are things that Shakespeare, as his world changed, he had a front row seat at all of that. And so the stories he wrote at a time of great disruption, just think about the power of the printing press. And the idea from the Reformation that under the, as it were, universal priesthood of all believers, that every single person had something monumentally important to say about the world and their lives, and here's the printing press to allow them to say it. That world of really tectonic media change brought about by the printing press and the printed book has some of the features of the world we're living in when presidential candidates can speak directly and at any hour of the day to the millions of people they want to have vote for them. That is, to my mind, as someone who studies Shakespeare, I mean, we could say, oh, well, Hillary Clinton is like this character and Donald Trump is like that one. But I don't think that's the most important story here. The important story is that there are moments of really powerful change that happen from changes in culture and the economy, but also media. And one of the things that allows Shakespeare to keep speaking to us is that he lived in a world that was heaving from changes that are very similar.
Very true. And for him, his real medium is performance here, isn't it? Which should fold into this also for us, maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you think of the ephemeral art form that is theater, it's an art form like dance that just disappears as soon as it happen. I mean, the closest we get to that, I guess, is Snapchat. But so much more of our politics is now conducted in a medium that we would think of as ephemeral, which is the short phrase, the soundbite, the thing that you could have just said to someone passing in the hallway, which is often what Twitter can capture. Really, really amazing.
Epigram, I guess, is you know,
comes
to mind very much, doesn't it, with Twitter? So. I'd like to thank you, Michael, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about the Folger Library and Shakespeare Studies.
It's a pleasure. Delighted to do it.
Yeah, it's been great.